Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peake, MUFON field investigator in the state of Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia. And before we discuss who's going to be coming on the show today, our official sponsor of our show is the podcast called Let's Find Out with co-host Diego. They make everything that we do here every week possible. So if you guys want to go check that out, he covers the topics that we basically cover here, UFOlogy, the paranormal, and cryptozoology. So all the fun stuff, and he has authors and all kinds of people on. It's a great show, great quality, and great information over there. Again, that's called Let's Find Out with co-host Diego. You can get that information on all podcast platforms in the description of this episode or over at our website and all social media. So please go check him out and give him a like. Today we're going to welcome special guest Jennifer Stein. Jennifer is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. She's also been a part of MUFON for the past 23 years as a state section director, focusing on outreach and education. She's also the creator of Mainline MUFON here in Philadelphia, doing monthly in-person meetings. And she, for 25 years, she's been researching megalithic structures all around the world, traveling to these sites and really doing some great investigating and researching into them. So we have tons of information to go over today. So like we always like to say, strap on them seatbelts, we're going for a ride. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of UFO Encounters Worldwide. This is your host, Jesse Peake, MUFON field investigator in the state of Pennsylvania, city of Philadelphia. And today's episode is sponsored by the podcast Let's Find Out with co-host Diego. You can get any of that information in the description of the episode below or over at our website at ufoencountersworldwide.wordpress.com. Today, we're sitting down with special guest Jennifer Stein, who is an award-winning documentary filmmaker. She's been involved with MUFON for over 23 years and has been researching megalithic structures for 25 years, going to these locations and doing great research work. Jennifer, welcome to the show today.
Thank you, Jesse. It's a great pleasure to be on with you.
Absolutely. I've been wanting to have this conversation with you for a while. You were here in Philadelphia for a long time. You're running the Mainline MUFON stuff that you started. So it's great to have you on today. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you. Yeah, that Mainline MUFON's been like a 22-year endeavor.
Yeah, it's great. I love having the in-person meetings. Some states don't have that, so we're lucky that you started that here, I think it's marvelous. So I guess I wanted to ask you, because I didn't know the answer to this question. How did you get started in this field? Was it an experience, a sighting, or was it something you came across and it sparked your interest?
Well, certainly the UFO field, I did have a sighting in 1975. It was probably August or the beginning of September. I did have it in the journal for many, many years, but then my house got hit by a tornado.
Oh, wow.
The journal is now gone because the tree hit my house and took out my attic. So the journal entry's gone, but I did record it quite clearly. I had an early morning light experience that did not make sense. It was 5:30 in the morning. I had some missing time. It was very, very bright. And I thought I was alone at the time when I had the experience. And then I realized 25 years later, I'd had a house guest at the time, and we never talked about it, but a friend of mine had the same experience I did. He was asleep in a different part of the house. So somehow we both had this very odd experience and encounter with a rectangle of white light that was less than 500 feet away and pretty large and undulating, but it didn't light anything else up, but it affected our consciousness for sure. And so that weird experience was what tweaked my interest, because I journaled it. I began to realize that I thought my experience was real, but I wasn't quite sure if it was like a weird dream. Right. And then 25 years later, I was able to kind of pull it out of the gray box and say, okay, if he had the same experience I had, then this was probably real. And it really began my quest at that point. That was around 1999 and 2000. And that's when I began to really start to unpack that experience and what it meant. And I started to go to conferences and meet speakers and read books. And then I started Mainline MUFON in 2022 as a way to, I'm sorry, in 2002, not 22, 2002. I started it as a way to learn more quickly, bring in speakers, share, you know, that with other people, and do it as a service for the Mutual UFO Network. Because if I was learning, other people could learn at the same time. And I did it at a public library, as you know, we were speaking about that earlier. And it's been a really blessing for me and for a lot of other people.
So how did you ever find out that you had the missing time? Did you realize that when the experience happened, or did you realize that after?
Yes, I had been journaling at the time, my dreams, and I had been journaling them. As soon as I woke up, I would grab a journal, write down the time and write down the date, and then what I could remember of the dream. I had read a book by Edgar Cayce, trying to access and connect with my subconscious mind. So I would basically expand my consciousness and be a little more aware of what subconscious thoughts might be driving my personal agendas in my waking state that I might not be aware of. It was sort of an expanded book at the time. I was about 19 and I had been journaling my dreams and then also journaling what was going on in my life and then flipping back and forth between these pages as the book described the exercise to do. So I grabbed my journal and wrote it all down as it was starting to happen. I woke up at 5:30, it was dark outside, I was trying to remember a dream, and I was distracted by this weird light that was about 45 degrees on the horizon and about a mile and a half away, and it was a rectangle of brilliant white light, and it was stationary, and that's just not normal.
No.
So that's why I ended up remembering it and noting it, because I was dream journaling and then day journaling as well. And that's why I had this entry in my journal that didn't make any sense.
So did the friend that was at the house, did he experience the same thing, or was there a difference in the experience?
Mostly, yes. Mostly he experienced the same thing. We both had a sense of being somewhat paralyzed or frozen in time. I don't really think an actual abduction took place. I think it was more of a download of information. And I also think when you're in the presence of high-level craft that use anti-gravitational fields, that it distorts time. And that you can have time interceptions or time breaks or slips in time when you're near craft that function in a multidimensional way, because they drop in and drop out of our dimension so dynamically, and they interface with our laws of physics in ways that we don't understand. And I think that's exactly what happened to both of us. We both sort of had a download. We both became much more psychic, much more precognitive, and right. You know, intuitive and aware. And it's interesting because I had been seeking that by reading the book from Edgar Cayce. So it was kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Maybe I had asked or reached out for some help to the greater universe, and maybe this help showed up in a way where I had this encounter.
Right. Yeah. I've heard that before. And my experience is kind of like that. You know, when you get into the field and you're looking at it, it's kind of like putting your own antenna up, saying, hey, I'm open to this. You know, you can come and share, you know.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm glad to hear you've had some similar experiences yourself. We've never spoken in depth, Jesse, although I have a great respect for what you're doing.
Thank you. We will. We'll definitely have to do that, especially with Mainline MUFON. We'll definitely do that another time. But I want to definitely hear about you've done so much stuff, you know, and I want to make sure we get to that today. You know, you've been a part of MUFON for 23 years, and you are a state section director, and you focused on outreach and education. Could you tell us a little bit about that and what you've done over the years?
Sure. Actually, there's probably, I don't know how deep the archive is, but for a while I kept an archive at Mainline MUFON. I lived on the Main Line of Philadelphia, and MUFON stands for, of course, the Mutual UFO Network. So mainlinemufon.com is the website for the local programming I started in 2002. And actually, the day I started it was the 1 year anniversary of 9/11, which wow. kind of freaked me out a little bit because I thought, oh my gosh, nobody's going to show up. You know, this is a horrendous day of tragedy for our country. Who's going to want to come hear a program about crop circles? And I'd actually asked for an omen to if I was supposed to actually do the Mainline MUFON programming, because I was in debate if anybody would even want to come or care, because that was the only day available at the library. Every other evening was booked or they were closed. And I asked for guidance on it. And that day I got a phone call out of the blue from the local television network down in Philadelphia called CN8, or I guess it's some kind of local cable network, and they broadcast all over the East Coast. And a producer named Lynn Doyle asked me to come on her program and talk about crop circles, because I was going to be presenting on crop circles.
Wow.
Somehow she found out through a friend of a friend that I would be presenting on crop circles, and she asked me to come down and evaluate Night Shyamalan's film on crop circles called Signs. So suddenly I was on a local cable network within days of me starting Mainline MUFON, and I was able to announce it on television, and I had over 60 people who showed up.
Wow, how about that?
I consistently had 50 to 60 people that showed up ever since. So that's the way the universe kind of, you know, you can have a give and take, a question and answer with your reality in the universe. If you're creative enough and brave enough to try it, it's quite interesting. So that's how I kind of got started with it. And then I just continued to bring in speakers, as you know, and I had speakers on multiple subjects: consciousness and precognition and life after death, and even, you know, science things. We've had the Higgs boson discussed, we've had the B collapse discussed, we've had environmental issues brought to people's attention, we've had programs on food and what was going on with Monsanto and how to stay as healthy and as clear from, you know, chemicals and combatants in the environment as we can, as well as programs on ancient sites and ancient archaeology and maybe missing pieces of our human history we don't know, like who built the pyramids, what could the pyramids possibly be for, you know, various people who had traveled to the pyramids. We had come in and speak and give presentations. So it's, you know, once you start connecting in with this field, it's very likely that you'll go to a conference, meet a group of other people, get inspired, take their, you know, exchange business cards, invite them to come and speak, which is what I did. And I've brought people in on all sorts of subjects, from Zachariah Sitchin when he was still alive. We had him present several times in Philadelphia, and, you know, Richard Dolan, who's been very well known, and Stephen Bassett, and Dr. Lynn Katai, and Travis Walton, and the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, Kathleen Martin, has come in and presented. And of course, we just had Richard Lang a few weeks ago. So it's really a blessing to get to meet other people who are also exploring these difficult and hard to piece together realities that we live with. But now that the UFO subject is out of the box, it's really important that we have a way to educate the public, because, you know, the public's been told for 75 years the UFO subject isn't real.
Right.
And now suddenly, you know, we're having congressional hearings on it. What is the public to do? Where are they to go to get an education on these out of the box subjects? There's just no way, unless they start their own initiative and start going to programs or meetings and seek out groups like Mainline MUFON or other groups. Like, I'm now running Sedona MUFON because I moved to Arizona. So it's really been quite a blessing. And I'm also still getting 50 to 60 people that show up at the meetings, you know, so it's quite a blessing. And then you're, of course, meeting and developing a network of like-minded people that you can at least explore ideas with and learn from.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's great that you're doing this. It's so well-rounded with the information. It's not just focused on one thing. So you're getting a plethora of great information from great sources.
Yes. Yes. Well, thank you, Jesse. I'm glad you've been the recipient of some of these programs.
Yes.
And I think it's inspired you to do the work you're doing, or hopefully it has.
Absolutely.
Because you're really reaching out as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. So you did mention that, you know, with the hearings and everything, and you being a state section director, I wanted to know, have you seen an increase in cases from witnesses and experiencers that are reporting their cases now that it's in the public view?
Yes, there is a slight uptick. MUFON has been noting that as well for the last 2 years. There's a lot more people reporting things. And I wouldn't necessarily say there's a lot more definitive unknowns, because that's really what a MUFON field investigator does. They go out and interview someone who's had a weird light in the sky or something strange they can't understand. And then we try to make it unknown, either by, astronomical positioning, and depending on what they're reporting, we kind of say, well, you know, was it a star? Was it Venus? Did it stay stationary? Was it just bright? Was it fluctuating? Was it moving? And if we can identify what it was, like a drone being used by police that might look unusual, you know, we'll go and we'll check out all the different types of public information we can find out from the FAA or from the local police department or from, you know, local astronomical charts. And we'll see if there's some kind of weather inversion or something weird that went on when they had their sighting. And if we can't pin it down, then we list it as an unknown. And that's what trained field investigators do. So I wouldn't necessarily say we've had more unknowns, but we've had more reports to deal with across the country for sure.
And how's it been different from being in PA as a section director to Arizona? Because I know PA is seventh all time in sightings. How is Arizona with the sighting aspect?
Well, we have a fantastic crew here in Phoenix, where I live. And I run up to Sedona and run programs there. It's about a 2 hours north of me. But we have a consistent number of reports every month. And they vary. I mean, sometimes in the winter months, people just are not out as much. Even though it's warmer here in Arizona, it's still cool at night. It could be, 40, 50, 60 at night in January, February, March, things like that. So we have consistently varied between 15 to 20 reports all the way up to, 25 to 30 reports every month. But they are consistent. And the great thing that they do at the Phoenix MUFON meetings is they give you a report summary, and they show you right away how many reports have come in, how many were, completed as field investigation projects, and how many were unknowns. And there's always a consistent 2, 3, 4, or 5 that are unknown. So it's really quite interesting. In fact, there's been a lot of activity in Sedona. Just October 3rd, 4th, and 5th, there was a whole series of reports that came in. And I had people phoning me, actually, to tell me what they were seeing. A series of orange lights, sort of over an Air Force base that's up there, not far, sort of between Sedona and Prescott. So I thought that was very interesting. So it's, we're always looking up. In fact, even I saw something very unusual last night. I didn't report it, but it was a vehicle moving sort of in a zigzag pattern back and forth across the sky, not coming any closer. It wasn't an airplane, wasn't moving over me. It stayed stationary. I thought it was an airplane because I could see a green light on one side, when it faced me that way, and then it would turn, and then maybe it was a red light on the other, but it kept going back and forth and then standing still. And then kind of reversing around and going back the other way. So planes don't really stand still.
No, not at all.
And it was very weird. It was too far away for me to really know. And I didn't have binoculars and it was dark, but I was eating dinner outside going, well, what the heck is that?
Right.
And that was just last night. So I was like, wow, Okay.
So that was
a strange place where we are in the desert.
Yeah, absolutely. I've had Dr. Lynn Katai on recently, and Shane Hurd from Arizona.
And
they talked about the sightings out there. But my next question was, you know, was there any good recent sightings that you worked on? And you were just talking about the orange lights that you see in the sky. Could you kind of tell us a little bit more detail of what exactly was seen on those 3 days?
Well, I can tell you that the person who reported it to me was Melinda Leslie.
Oh,
and
okay.
She does regular night watches in Sedona.
Yes.
And she's the one that called me on the phone. I was actually in Canada at the time. So for me, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. For her, it was about 10 or 11 o'clock at night. And she was rambling on and I was staying with a friend. I was a guest in someone else's house. And I felt, oh my goodness, I was so embarrassed that my phone rang. And then this person was chattering away. I was afraid I was waking up the whole house. But I actually don't do field investigation myself. I do just the public outreach and education.
Okay.
So I encourage Linda to report it, to Phoenix MUFON directly, so that, you know, maybe a field investigator would check it out. But the only thing we could pin down that it seemed to be over an Air Force base somewhere up in that regional area. And there were multiple types of orange balls of light that got larger, like as big as a moon, and then got smaller again. And then there was electric static around them, and then larger and smaller, and some moving around. But it was a series of unusual orange balls of light. And they could see them sort of coming down and going back up, you know, from the air down to the surface and back up. And it was quite exciting because that's... Usually you can see unusual things in the sky at night that don't follow the trajectory of maybe a satellite, or you think it's a satellite because it's moving at a pretty good clip and then it stops.
Yep.
And then it goes back the other way and you're like, okay. And when you're up in an area like Sedona, where there's not a lot of light pollution, like we would have down here in Phoenix, you're about 2 hours north of that light pollution, and there are only small towns around there. So your view of the night sky can be really quite good, which is why Melinda Leslie runs these night watches. And she helps point out to people what is actually taking place. And she's very careful, like not to point a laser at an airplane.
Right.
You know, at night, because that can be very dangerous. But she does point out, okay, that's a plane, but this is not. Look at this. This is higher. That's a satellite. So she points out star constellations, and it's really quite educational. So I have to tell you, I don't know what the results were of any investigation in the reporting that was done on that case, but it just goes to show that there's a lot of activity here. And I encourage anyone who comes out to Sedona to definitely go out, check out the night sky, and maybe take one of these nighttime, tours with people where they meet after dark, usually about, it varies depending on the time of year. Now it's getting dark here around 7, but in the summer, it's kind of, you have to wait probably closer till 9:30 or 10. For the sky to really get dark, but they do them almost every night up in Sedona.
Yeah, that's incredible. And Linda, I had her on the show a while back. She talked about doing these, and I think it's incredible that people can go there and have these tours and be taken to the correct locations and get educated on the subject as well, because she's got a very good background with it, doing research and investigation. So that's great.
Oh, yeah, she does. And I also recommend her because she will point out what is not a UFO. She will clearly show you constellations. She'll talk about, you know, this time of year, what's close to the Earth, what's not. She'll talk about eclipses. I mean, she's really quite knowledgeable about, you know, due location. She knows her northeast, west, you know,
right,
and south very clearly. And she'll really tell you what you're looking at and help you to explain and understand the night sky. So then when you're looking on your own, you have a better education of
right,
what you're looking at.
Yep. And I think that's the best way to do it. You want somebody that's not going to point everything out as a UFO. And
right,
you want to understand what you're looking at when you're looking at an object in the night sky. So that's great.
Right.
I love that.
Right.
So I want to go ahead and go take our break real quick. And when we get back, we can kind of get into your research into the megalithic structures, which I find very fascinating. Big part of this subject. So we're going to go ahead and take our break, and we'll be back right after these commercial messages.
Have you always been curious about the unknown, the unexplainable? Do you find yourself intrigued by the mysterious and paranormal side of our world? Then Let's Find Out with co-host Diego is the podcast for you. Join in on an adventure into the world of the inexplicable and get insights from experienced researchers, investigators, and experts. Listen to mind-bending discussions and fascinating stories as Let's Find Out explores the strange, mysterious, and paranormal. Let's Find Out with co-host Diego is a unique and engaging podcast that uncovers the mysteries of the cryptic and unknown. With insightful interviews and discussions, they discover the very latest theories, discoveries, and investigations that may someday give us the final answer as to what may be behind the veil of reality. Available on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, YouTube, iHeartRadio, Radio Public, TuneIn, and Rumble.
UFO Encounters Worldwide would like to announce our brand new home at the UNX Network. Listen to us every Saturday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to hear UFO Encounters Worldwide podcast. That's on the UNX Network.
UFO Encounters Worldwide wants to hear from you. Have an experience or a sighting you want to share? Contact your host, Jesse Peake, at UFOEncountersWorldwide@gmail.com today.
This is your host, Jesse Peake. Check out our official website at UFOEncountersWorldwide.wordpress.com. Read up on UFO articles, including abductions, close encounters, sighting cases, megalithic structures, and more. Also, check out our new Facebook group. You'll get updates on guests every week, new events coming up, and our schedule of who we're going to have on in the future. Again, that's UFO Encounters Worldwide Facebook group and our website at UFOEncountersWorldwide.wordpress.com. Looking to get some UFO merchandise? We'll get some UFO Encounters Worldwide official stickers, and we also have pins. Check out our selection, DM us or email us if you're interested for inquiry, and we'll show you our selection. All pins and stickers are $3 each and $1 shipping, or you can mix and match any five for $10 and free shipping. DM us or send us an email if you're interested. Welcome back to the second half of episode 107 as we're sitting down with our special guest, Jennifer Stein. So in 2023, you were an associate producer for an award-winning documentary, and you've also produced one yourself, which was an award-winning documentary, Travis, The True Story of Travis Walton. Would you like to tell us a little bit how you got involved with Travis and got into the documentary filmmaking part?
Oh, sure. I would love to. I, of course, like many people, knew about the Travis Walton story because of the Paramount Picture film called Fire in the Sky. But I was delightfully surprised when I finally got to meet Travis at the Roswell UFO conference one year. I was running it in 2010 with Peter Robbins. I was sort of an assistant and organizing the whole conference, and I got to hear Travis speak. And after the conference, a group of the coordinators and speakers went out to dinner. And a group of us sat around and said, Travis, you know, your story is just as significant as the Roswell story. Right. And it's uniquely different. But it's no less important because of the significance of his story, Peter and I said to him, why don't you think about running a conference yourself, you know, up there in the Snowflake area, or Heber or Holbrook, one of those three cities that were all sort of engaged with the incident that took place in 1975. Why don't you consider that? And he was like, you know, shrugging his shoulder, saying, well, you know, I present, but I don't really have the skills to put a conference together. And lo and behold, somehow Peter and I convinced him that we would help him do the first conference in and I think it was the 39th anniversary leading up to the 40th anniversary. And that's how I ended up getting involved in doing film work around his story, because it occurred to me that it could snow up there in November and we couldn't be out in the forest doing a night watch in the middle of the winter with snow on the ground and having 100 people hike, you know, 45 minutes into the forest. Right. I said, that might not work. Maybe we should film something in the summer. Right. And then we can, you know, have a little film we can present at the conference if you want to take people to the site. And that's honestly how I got started. I kind of really walked into this from the back door very naively. And one thing led to another. And I realized that I was running the 2014 symposium for MUFON in Philadelphia, and I had a number of great speakers coming in that I could interview, like Lee Spiegel and Ben Hansen and Kathleen Martin and, you know, just a number of other people. And so I sat a number of people down, interviewed them about Travis's case, and then I flew out to Arizona and interviewed all the boys in the crew in the summertime and took them up to the forest, and we did walkthroughs of the forest and talked to them about what the experience was like. And then I decided that I could interview the police people who were still alive, the sheriff and the deputy who were involved in his case. And then I got the brilliant idea, heck, the man who did the polygraph examinations on all the crew, because the crew was accused of murdering Travis, I could interview him. And suddenly I realized I had the making of a fabulous documentary film, which had never been done. And it just kind of, the light bulb went off, and I had to put, you know, pedal to the metal, grindstone sort of thing, and sit down at the editing board and do the best job I could. And then I enlisted the help of a nephew of mine who was in film school, or just had graduated from film school, named Adam Stein. And Adam really helped take a 4 to 5 hour film I had and narrow it down to 90 minutes with the most important and critical information that was needed, because a lot of filmmaking is about more about what you don't include as well as what you do include.
Right.
It may sound counterintuitive, but you know, it's sometimes it's very hard to narrow down and figure out, okay, what's the best way to tell this story? And really having a good storyteller like Travis and an incredible story like he has made it really possible. So I just claim I was at the right place at the right time, but it's really Travis's story. And that's why the film won as many film awards, because it was more of a personal story about the tragedy that occurred in all these loggers' lives as a result of having a significant UFO encounter, because right. They were all Mormon men. And this ruined a lot of their lives. They never worked together as a crew. Many of them got into fights and arguments after that. And they're still not necessarily what I would say the best of friends. You might think they might be because of what they've been through, but there's been a lot of animosity and confusion and accusations that have been made back and forth. And it's still a very difficult topic for all of them to address.
Yeah.
So I'd hope that my documentary would bring some reconciliation and some acknowledgement and recognition to what these men experienced. And I think for that, I accomplished that. And the story is more well known now because of the documentary. It's in multiple languages. It's, you know, screened around the world. And you can see it on Amazon Prime, even on YouTube now, it's up. I got a nice distributor, and he's given me many platforms of which to distribute the film for, and I'm very grateful for the success of that film.
Yeah, I think it was done very, very well. The original wasn't as accurate as it should have been. I've also heard that from many people. So this was the
more accurate. You mean that Fire in the Sky, the Hollywood film. Yeah, that's right. That Travis was very disappointed because they changed the story on him. They made it much more scary on board the craft than it really was. And that's the most one of the most important parts of Travis' story, when he wakes up on board a craft and he encounters two different species that are there trying to help him, you know, and that interaction that he remembers on board the craft is very significant for the UFO community.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Absolutely.
I think it was definitely a good thing. And I think it really opened up people to his story more accurately and made them understand more of what happened and what they went through, like you said, because it was a tragedy. I mean, these men were accused of murder. And they had families thinking that they were killing them and burying his body out in the woods. I mean, it got crazy.
Yes. It was really a disaster for what they experienced. And that was captured a little bit in Fire in the Sky. They sort of did a better job with that than they did with what happened to Travis himself.
Right.
And then, of course, when Travis came back, the trauma that he went into, none of that was really covered in the Fire in the Sky film. But that's really what we focus on in the documentary about Travis, and also about the debunking that went on, which followed them for 30 years.
Right.
There was even a debunker that offered one of the youngest crew members $10,000 to say it was all a hoax.
Yep.
That was Philip Klass. He did his best to try to debunk the subject. And, you know, so like I say, the rest is history. But that's why documentaries are really good, because you get a 40-year perspective when you watch the Travis film, rather than just, you know, the instantaneous thing that happened in the forest in 1975.
Right. Yeah, I absolutely applaud you. I think you did an excellent job with it. I think it was a great thing to be redone like that, the proper way. So that was great. Now, you were also recently worked on the 2023 film Accidental Truth, which was also another award-winning documentary. Could you tell us a little bit about that as well?
Yes, of course, I would love to. So I had the chairperson position of the 2018 symposium dropped on my lap just about 6 months before that symposium came off. So in Pennsylvania. So we hosted it in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And I, again, had fabulous speakers coming in to present at the symposium, including the gentleman who had basically broken the secrecy on the UFO subject, Luis Elizondo, who was part of the Aerial Threat Identification Program at the Pentagon, had recently come forward in December of 2017, the year just before, at the end of the year. He stepped out of the Pentagon and threw his hands up and said, look, I resign. I'm not going to do this job anymore. I'm not really being paid for it. And the UFO subject is a very serious one, and it needs to be addressed. And he and Leslie Keene, Ralph Blumenthal, and Helene Cooper broke a story in the New York Times, which made national headlines around the world. And it was really the beginning of disclosure in a big time. And it's what's led to the congressional hearings that we've seen just recently.
Absolutely.
So, and there's been a series of congressional hearings. There's been two or three now. And it's led to new demands from Congress to have transparency and no longer have a black budget that we don't know, where appropriations are being pulled off of other assigned categories from the governmental budget and then disappear into a black budget because it's needed for the military. So that will change the face of public awareness. And we felt that making a documentary about that change, that rapid change, like 70 years of secrecy, oops, and now it's out of the box. What? And the backpedaling that's going on between Congress and between whistleblowers, and the safety that's needed for pilots to come forward and be able to talk. I mean, it has been a real cat and mouse game, where someone will come forward with information and then their hand will get slapped and they'll be told, no, you weren't allowed to say that. And they're like, well, you know, you are having congressional hearings on it, and you have asked for whistleblowers to come forward. I think it's time you have to give, protection to these whistleblowers so they can't be prosecuted if they have non-disclosures, but you want them to come forward with their information. So we felt that that really needed to be tackled in a more in-depth way. So we sat down Luis Elizondo first off at this 2018 symposium and interviewed him in depth. And that began the documentary film. We had no idea what it was going to be called. But eventually, one of the interviews that Ron James did with Gary Nolan, he sort of confessed that there's some things he can't talk about, and the fact that it's out there is probably just an accidental truth. And the light bulb went off in Ron's head, and he was like, ah, that's a good name for a film. So I have to give Ron James full credit for this film. I'm only an associate producer on it, but it means that I was involved in the initial beginning of it. I helped do a number of the interviews. I got the agenda set up. I spent a lot of time on the phone back and forth with Ron, but this is really Ron's baby. So I give Ron James, who was the head of MUFON Television, complete accolades for the great success he's had with this film. And it itself has now won, gosh, I think close to 20 film festival awards as well, which we're very happy about. And it continues to make the rounds. Yeah, so it's a much needed film on disclosure and on understanding the UFO subject.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's actually funny that I have you on this week because Ron James is coming on next week.
Oh, that's perfect. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it works out good, right?
It works out great.
So that's great. I think it's really going to open people's eyes, and they need a good film like that to let people understand all the things that went on behind the scenes that doesn't come out in the public view with the news and things like that. So that'll be great for people. Another thing I wanted to talk about is you have been researching megalithic structures for 25 years, and you've traveled to so many of these locations. This is something that part of the phenomenon and the ancient astronaut theory that I'm really, I really like. So would you like to tell us how you got started with that?
Well, I think probably when I was in high school, I was reading National Geographic and looking at pictures of Stonehenge and noting the mound that was around the outside of Stonehenge as well, the earthen mound. And I started to read about ancient sites. And, you know, I think I just got bit by the curiosity bug early in life. And then as I stepped into the UFO field, and I started to have the privilege of going to a number of different conferences and hearing different speakers, and reading books like by Eric Von Doniggan, and David Childress, and Graham Hancock, and Robert Duvall, I just, as well as Zach Sitchin, I just began to devour the curiosity about ancient sites. And then, you know, looking at National Geographic and looking at the pyramids, I'm thinking, my gosh, how big they are and how perfect they are. And then I, you know, when I could afford it, it was my bucket list early on to say, okay, if I have the opportunity to go to such and such a site with this particular writer, then I definitely want to go. So, you know, early on, I think in 2009, I went to Egypt with John Anthony West. And he's been an incredible writer and was inspired by much earlier writers as well, who first noticed the incredible megalithic size and perfection of some of the earliest structures in Egypt way back in the 1920s, like Schwaller de Lubitsch was a French writer. And he wrote about the sacred geometry of the architecture in Egypt, and how even the statues were perfect the way they were carved, and the rooms had rounded corners in a lot of the various temples that were there, and the different types of temples that were there, some being much, much older, and then some being newer. So you could tell the difference between a much earlier civilization, which we don't know who built it, and it's megalithic and perfect and smooth, large blocks of stone fit together without any type of mortar. And then you find some of the Egyptian walls and temples built with similar monstrosity, but then completely carved and, you know, with depictions and stories that go back to the ancient world. and the stories of Atlantis, which we don't, you know, we don't know exactly if it existed, but there's a lot of evidence that it probably did, because it exists in historical references in Sumerian texts and also in Egyptian texts and in Babylonian texts. So we need to begin to look at the potential that, you know, human civilization is much, much older than we've been taught. And the technology that was here building some of these incredible megalithic structures that you see in places like Pumapunku, Ollantaytambo, Machu Picchu, of course, Egypt, and even in places in Greece and in Italy, you can find structures under newer structures built on top of them. And when you look at the foundations to some of these platforms or buildings, even in Israel, if you look at the Temple Mount and you go underneath in some of the tunnels and you look at the structural stones that make up the base of that Temple Mount, they're like the stones of Baalbek in Syria. It's a stone that's bigger than three semis, and it's solid and it's huge and it's thousands of tons. And you think, and it's perfectly carved, square, long, rectangular pillar. And you think, well, who the heck did that and built that? So you just begin to realize that because the stones are there and because they're carved in the way that they are and smoothed and positioned and placed tightly together, you know that somebody built it. It's not like it's a light in the sky you see that flies away. It's a very tangible thing.
Right. Yeah.
And so we know that there had to be advanced civilizations and cultures on this earth. And whether or not they are connected to a higher intelligence species that was here, or whether or not it was just human engineering at that time that was highly elevated, we don't yet know. But we do know certain things from studying these megalithic sites, and that is that the ancient cultures paid attention to the sky, and they built a lot of their structures with astronomical alignments to vernal equinoxes and to solstices, and they positioned their whole structures on the ground sometimes to mimic constellations on the sky.
Right.
Even the Sphinx, we believe, faces Leo, the constellation of Leo on the vernal equinox, and it was most likely originally a lion and then recarved with a face to be just one of the pharaohs many thousands of years later. So I've had the privilege of studying with people like Robert Schock, you know, who's well known for dating the encasement wall behind the Sphinx as having been water eroded a good 10,000 years.
Yes.
Which of course means that, well, then that encasement wall would have had to been created, and the Sphinx would have had to been created at least at a period of time when that was a tropical rainforest. And then it water eroded for 10,000 years before then it got buried in the sand for thousands of years and then rediscovered by the pharaoh Khufu, who uncovered it. So, you know, there's pieces of logical understanding of Earth history, geologic history, and there's ways of looking at stone structures and the erosion that's taken place in them where you just know beyond a shadow of a doubt that, you know, if we can date a mountain in a certain way from water erosion, we can date the encasement wall around the Sphinx as well.
Absolutely.
And logic and science eventually rules out, even though certain, you know, cultures, maybe certain aspects of the Egyptian culture, don't want to admit that there was any earlier intelligent group besides the Egyptian dynasties, which they'd like to recognize. But there might be much earlier dynasties we don't know about. I mean, the Nubians go much further back in history than what we know about relatively modern Egyptian history, which I would say is like 3000 BC up to, you know, 2000 AD. You know, there was a much larger and older culture there. There had to be,
right,
just like there had to be in other parts of the world.
So with the megalithic structures that you have looked at, which ones do you think bear the most fruit as to evidence of advanced civilizations back before our time?
Well, what I've begun to discover is the overlap and the similar construction techniques that you can find in places like the Sphinx Temple, which sits in right in front of the Sphinx. And then you can find walls in Turkey that are built the same way, and walls in Easter Island that are built the same way, and walls in Peru that are built the same way, and Bolivia, and probably even in Romania, I believe we've seen some, and in Russia. And then you also start to look at megalithic sites around the world, in Japan and Malaysia, and oh my gosh. It's mind-blowing, the overlap, almost as if there was, in some cases, a school of architecture that was worldwide understood how to get huge blocks together and not let them move in earthquake.
Yes.
And have them, you know, stand the test of time and be protective structures for civilizations. And it's literally mind-boggling. So there are so many structures around the world, and of the ones I've been to see, I've stood there just dumbfounded, like you don't even know how to digest it.
Right.
But it's mind-blowing, and then you're very grateful that you've been to see it, because once you see something with your own eyes, you can't put it back in the small Pandora's box you had it in before.
100%. Yep. Yeah, that's absolutely great. Yeah, it's something that I definitely have on my bucket list. I definitely want to go and see some of these megalithic structures. Eric von Daniken, when he Chariot to the Gods, that book. Once I read that book, I was completely hooked on the megalithic structure aspect of this whole phenomenon. So it's absolutely amazing.
I highly encourage you to, and any of your listeners, I would highly recommend traveling with Robert Schock, Brian Forrester, Hugh Newman. Are just a few right off the top who really take you to some incredible megalithic sites. You'll learn things from them. You won't hear the typical story if you go on your own, say with a church group or just a tour group or something to Peru. You'll have a lot further explanation, and you'll be exposed to a lot more information, say if you go to Peru with someone like Brian Forrester who's there, or if you go to places in Europe or Greece or Turkey or Egypt with Hugh Newman or Robert Schock. I highly recommend that too.
Absolutely. And I know they have those different trips you can go on, the cruises, and you can go with these individuals and go to these places. So
it's cool. Yes, Hugh Newman runs Megalithomania, and he does wonderful conferences in the UK. So people could go over there, and usually I think they're in May in Glastonbury.
Okay.
And sometimes he did them in the United States, up in Glastonbury, Connecticut as well. But I think he's only doing them in the UK now.
Yeah, there's definitely something to keep an eye out for, definitely to take advantage of when looking at this kind of stuff. But we're actually at the end of the show, Jennifer. I want to thank you for coming on today. But before we end, do you want to tell everybody where they can kind of follow your work, what you're doing, if you want to give any other information out?
Oh, if people are in Arizona and they want to know about Sedona's programs, they can go to sedonamufon.org. That's O-R-G at the end. And if they want to join some of our Zoom programs online, they can go to Mainline. Those are two words based on the Main Line of Philadelphia, mainlinemufon.com. And they can join some of our Zoom programs by signing up to get our Zoom reminder. We send something out usually 2 weeks and 2 days before an upcoming program or speaker. And, you know, if they want to know more about the Travis Walton film, they can go to traviswaltonthemovie.com. I think those are the things right off the top. And these days, if you just Google Accidental Truth, you'll find links to that movie as well. So it's been such a pleasure. Jesse, thank you so much for having me on your program.
Yeah, absolutely. I really enjoyed this conversation. It always flies by when you're having these kind of good conversations like this. I'll make sure I put the Sedona and Mainline MUFON links in the description of the episode. This way, so anybody listening, you guys can get that and check it out. Thank you again, Jennifer, for sharing all this information. I mean, you've been doing some amazing research and work over the years. It's great. And I appreciate you sharing that.
Thanks, Jesse.
No problem.
Have a great day.
You too. And I want to thank everybody for tuning in to episode 107 of UFO Encounters Worldwide. We'll be back next week with episode 108 and our special guest, Ron James. So until next time, remember to keep your eyes in the sky. Well, what another amazing episode. Tons of information that we went over today. Jennifer is doing some amazing work in the field of ufology with MUFON, the films that she's making. I mean, the megalithic structure research, absolutely amazing. Go check out her work on social media. Again, thank you very much, Jennifer, for coming on today and sharing all that with us. Next week, we are bringing special guest Ron James, who actually worked on the documentary film Accidental Truth with Jennifer Stein. He was the actual director. So it's interesting how they're coming on back to back like that. So that should be a really interesting episode. He does all the film producing and movies and all that kind of stuff for MUFON. He runs MUFON TV. So we'll have tons of information to go over with him. And again, please go and check out our sponsor, the official podcast, Let's Find Out with co-host Diego. You can get that information in the description of the episode below or over to our website or on social media. Let's Find Out with co-host Diego goes through ufology, the paranormal, and cryptozoology. So with all that being said, we'll see you guys next week for episode 108 with Ron James. And until next time, remember to keep your eyes in the sky.